This program is about unsolved mysteries. Whenever possible, the actual family members and police officials have participated in recreating the events. What you are about to see is not a news broadcast.
For nearly 20 years, Nancy Meyer has proved an invaluable tool for law enforcement. But Nancy is no ordinary investigator. She apparently employs psychic abilities to divine clues that might otherwise go unnoticed. Tonight, you'll see Nancy in action as she searches for answers in the tragic murder of a young girl in Florida. In 1980, 15-year-old Michelle Donahoe ran away from home. En route to Texas, Michelle was befriended by three good Samaritans who guided her through her dangerous journey. Michelle needs your help to find her protectors so she can finally say thank you. And one of the great mysteries of the sea. In 1872, a schooner christened the Mary Celeste weighed anchor in New York Harbor and set sail for Europe. 4 weeks later, she was found drifting in the Atlantic Ocean near Portugal. The Mary Celeste was in virtually perfect condition, yet the captain, his family, and the crew had inexplicably vanished. For more than a century, the mysterious fate of the ghost ship has tantalized storytellers and historians alike. Join me for this intriguing legend and much more on Unsolved Mysteries. What if your mind worked like a television set? What if you could change channels at will, tune into programs no one else could see? And what if you could never turn the set off? You're about to meet a remarkable woman named Nancy Meyer, who apparently has the extraordinary mind of a psychic. She didn't ask for it. She doesn't always like it. Yet she has learned to put it to good use.
When you are working with individuals yourself in the field, I am sure, because many cops have said this to me, I'm not psychic. No, I don't want to be weird like
Nancy Meyer of Greensburg, Pennsylvania, has been working with police departments around the country for nearly two decades. Her track record would be the envy of any detective. In some 300 criminal investigations, Nancy says she has turned up crucial new information more than 80% of the time.
It's like the ultimate challenge. Because most of my cases are murders. Only two people knew what happened, the victim and the killer. The only way to find out is telepathy.
When you find someone like her, and of course, after you get her where she wants to become involved, then you have yourself a tool, a fantastic tool. It's not gonna solve your crimes in a lot of cases, but it's gonna give you that extra bit of information where your investigators have the opportunity of going out and continuing the case.
This is the neighborhood where it all occurred.
I see.
Mostly during the
Nancy's first major case came in 1977, when a desperate detective in Wilmington, Delaware, asked her to help him track down an unknown serial rapist.
Interesting thing, though, is
I didn't really have any faith at all in psychics or whatever. We had never used one. I had never considered using one. But the women were hesitant about making identification, looking at pictures and stuff like that. And we was just kind of stuck, really.
Most people in the department were very skeptical of the psychic. As a matter of fact, to the point of it was a joke. That there goes poor Leroy Landon, my partner, off with his psychic, and you know, he must be getting old.
Do you remember what he looked like?
Yes.
The detectives had given Nancy no specific details about the rapes. At the home of the first victim, both men were stunned when Nancy was able to improve upon the victim's own sketch of the rapist.
Something with the eyes that's different about this. Do you mind changing the eyebrows a little bit?
Sure. The shape was a little bit off to me.
A little bit more, maybe.
And she thought about it, and she said, I think you're right. And then she made the change.
You know, you're right. It does look more.
And she said to the detectives, that's more accurate. She said, I knew there was something wrong with it. That's more accurate.
Thanks again, Mrs. Williams. We appreciate everything you've done for us. We'll be in touch.
When we were leaving, she reached out and grabbed my hand and forearm with her hands. All this stuff came pouring into my head, and all of a sudden I was getting much clearer pictures. It's like trying to watch a car and get the license number when it's traveling at an excessive speed. It's very hard to do that. And you have to sort of let all the information flow through and then try to slow it down and rerun it. And then I could see one image of him sleeping, so I could really study his features. Interspersed was this uniform. And I could see a number, but it was faded. And I could see an emblem, but it was faded. And it looked like a work suit, and it had these kind of clodhoppery black shoes and the white socks.
After the meeting, Nancy suddenly went into a trance-like state and literally took off down the street. The same thing would happen after she met each rape victim.
First, we would start off riding, then we would get out of the car and physically walk. And when she would go into her little, I guess you could call it, bloodhound type, tongue hanging out, scouting or patrolling or whatever you want to call it, we would be doing like a canvas but on foot. And you would have to watch her. I mean, because she definitely didn't pay attention to what she was doing, because she'd walk right out in the street or cross the street or whatever.
Nancy always seemed to end up at the same street corner in a residential area near downtown Wilmington.
He's around here somewhere.
Which way? Left, right, up the street, down the street?
I just kept looking up the street and saying, this is the street he's coming back to. I just followed him.
Way.
Down here on the left, the right, which one?
So then, you know, well, which house? Give me the house number, you know. We don't want a little bit, we want more. Oh, I gave you the street, what do you want? The house number would be real nice, and I just refused to go up the street. And they really pestered me. But they both knew me well enough to know that I wasn't budging. We can't get this close and pull away. I sort of was afraid he might walk out the door of a house and there I'd be nose to nose with him, and I didn't want that to happen.
The clues kept adding up, but nothing concrete emerged. Finally, Nancy accompanied one victim to the actual spot where the rape had happened. Nancy instinctively focused on the telephone.
Did he use the phone when he was here?
Amazingly, Nancy's hunch jogged the victim's memory. The rapist had used the phone. And more importantly, the yellow pages.
We took the phone book, naturally, and sent it down to the FBI and Washington Laboratory. And we did get a couple fingerprints.
Without a suspect, the fingerprints were useless. As the investigation progressed, Nancy found herself drawn back to the same street corner time after time.
You gotta go down that street now.
Now she knew she had to go farther.
We got guns.
Okay.
Half a block down Shellcross Avenue, Nancy stopped dead in her tracks.
This is it. This is the house. He definitely comes and goes from here.
By that time, I wasn't so skeptic anymore, personally. Of course, my partner, he still thinks I'm nuts at that point for fooling with her, but that's beside the point. So I had a little faith in her. So whatever she more or less said, I would definitely try to do something about it and make something out of it. Because I was a convert then. I was a believer in her.
Sorry about these files. They probably should be a little bit sharper.
The detectives immediately questioned the owner of the building.
This guy came in about a week ago. Yeah, he and his girlfriend. They take over a week this Monday. There you go.
Take a look.
Sure.
He gave me the name of the applicants for the apartment that was being refurbished.
Derek Stevens, I know that name. Why do I know that name?
Familiar? The man's name I recognized myself from another case previous.
Can't be the same guy.
No way, because he'd still be in jail.
So anyway, I call the jail, and I find out that he's on this work furlough release program or something, and that he's out every day looking for a job.
Suddenly, the pieces of the puzzle fell into place. Incredibly, the man's prison uniform mirrored Nancy's vision. A navy blue shirt, a serial number patch on the breast pocket, black shoes and white socks. But it was a prisoner's fingerprints that sealed his fate. They matched the prints lifted from the yellow pages.
Number three.
In the end, the suspect was identified by six of the victims.
It's him. I'm positive.
He was eventually convicted and sentenced to a total of 150 years in prison.
When I was called and told what had happened, it was like I had to keep asking them. And finally, one of the detectives said, "You don't really believe you did it, did you?" And I said, "No, I don't." It was just like incredible, because that one, I was able to produce more result each time I worked.
When you come to a dead end and you have no place to go, if you have someone who can open a door and say, "Hey, I think I can help you," and just through her psychic powers, she's able to put us out into another lead, then through good investigation techniques, we can go on and continue and solve the crime. And that's what we've done.
Being a psychic involves being able to pick up a great deal of information from a variety of things.
What are we to make of the apparent powers of Nancy Meyer? Does she have the uncanny ability to see and sense things that the rest of us can't? Last summer, we asked Nancy to travel to Brooksville, Florida, where the sheriff's department was investigating a particularly tragic murder case. 12-year-old Jennifer Odom was a bright, vivacious seventh grader. On the afternoon of February 19, 1993, she got off the school bus at a stop just 200 yards from her home. Then Jennifer vanished. The community mobilized. For nearly a week, hundreds of friends and neighbors combed the woods. Finally, 6 days after Jennifer disappeared, her body was found. She had been brutally murdered. 16 months later, Nancy Meyer would be brought in to work with local detectives.
I'll put these kind of over there because these are the ones I'll be working with.
The crime scene photographs in the Jennifer Odom case are classified, so Nancy was not allowed to view them.
Now I'm getting two individuals.
What you are watching is real. Even with the photographs turned face down on the table, Nancy was able to visualize not one, but two killers in detail.
6'1". He is of medium build. He looks to me to be quite, I want to say, almost wiry looking in the arms. His arms are not like powerful in the sense of muscle building, but powerful in the sense of someone who works and lifts or has lifted heavy things.
Where did the friend say she was? Over there?
The next day, Nancy visited the scene of the abduction, Jennifer's school bus stop.
Right in here.
Nancy began to tell the sheriff's detectives what she was sensing had happened.
Where is right now is where they stopped. And then the one guy came walking back, hailed her, started asking her directions.
The detectives listened to everything Nancy said, but at the time made no comment.
With the situation, she starts to move.
It's like being in a movie in my head. And I stand beside the victim, and I try to describe everything that I'm seeing as it unfolds.
Yeah, the minute she turned around.
And a lot of times that's really helpful to the police officers, because sometimes they have odd pieces of evidence at the scene they don't understand the significance of. And when I describe the sequence of events, it sometimes makes sense out of odd little pieces that they couldn't make any sense out of.
The spot where Jennifer's body was discovered is marked by flowers and a cross.
This is where you found her? I don't think this is where she died. I'm sure you took this whole place apart. Did you find some small metal jewelry of hers up in this area? Okay, like a medallion or something back in that direction.
All right, we did find some of her jewelry.
Okay. There's a feeling of something there.
She was extremely accurate on some things that kind of led us to look in other areas that we hadn't thought of. And so we basically, you know, obtained a lot of information from what she had to offer.
I was impressed with Nancy. Some things she said were so darn accurate, it's scary. And then some things she said were a little bit off the wall. But I was impressed, and I would definitely recommend her again.
Nancy went on to suggest that there was evidence in the area yet to be found.
There should be more stuff back in there. And there should be what would have looked like the strap off of some kind of a carry case or something. And it would have been black with lettering in like bluish colors. It would have looked fairly new. It was used to restrain her.
The hardest part of this is dealing with the devastation that people wreak on each other. I find it particularly difficult working on the cases of the children that have been killed.
They threw something at hers.
My heart just goes out to the families. I mean, it's frustrating to me when everything doesn't just fall into place.
It's supposed to be this side. I walked over the other side. I don't pick up any feeling on the other side, but I'm going to walk back up there as a cross check, but it just feels like you're starting out.
Near the memorial to Jennifer Odom, Nancy Meyer spoke of the possible existence of a carrying case with lettering on it. The sheriff's department has since revealed that Jennifer Odom had her cousin's clarinet with her when she was abducted. The letters L-O were on the carrying case. The name Odom was carved into the clarinet itself. Neither the clarinet, the case, nor Jennifer's white zip-up Pep Club sweatshirt with the word Hooters in orange on the left sleeve has ever been found. Next, the century-old mystery of the Mary Celeste. What happened to the captain and crew of the legendary ghost ship? It was a glorious time, the golden age of sailing ships. 100 years ago, graceful brigs and clippers rode the winds, linking Europe, America, and the exotic East. But not every ship reached her destination safely. On a crisp November morning in 1872, a brigantine named the Mary Celeste sailed from New York Harbor and into legend, enshrined as the most infamous ghost ship of them all.
Four weeks after embarking for Europe, the Mary Celeste would be found drifting several hundred miles off the coast of Portugal. Abandoned, but curiously still on course. The veil of mystery stretches back to the evening before the Mary Celeste departed, when her captain, one Benjamin Briggs, his wife, and a guest shared a quiet farewell dinner.
Mrs. Briggs, you must be looking forward to the weather in the Mediterranean this time of year.
Oh, I am.
Sarah and I feel that...
Benjamin Briggs of Marion, Massachusetts, had already captained ships for a decade when he took the helm of the Mary Celeste.
He came from a family of seafarers. He was considered quite a religious man. Captain Briggs was a noted good captain. He could be stern and so on, but he was always noted as being fair.
Are you bringing the children?
Sophie will be coming with us, and Arthur will remain here in school.
Benjamin's wife, Sarah, was herself a veteran of several voyages and would be along for the fateful trip. Much speculation is centered on the Briggs' guest that evening, Captain David Morehouse. His ship, the Dia Gratia, would sail for Europe 8 days after the Mary Celeste. Morehouse would be swept up in the bizarre events that were about to unfold. But some have asked whether by chance or by design.
Well, here's to a smooth crossing and calm seas.
God willing!
Perfect.
The next morning, November 5th, 1872, the Mary Celeste weighed anchor and set sail for Europe. Stowed securely below deck were more than 1,000 barrels of pure alcohol, highly prized in the Italian wine trade. It was a valuable but dangerous cargo. Alcohol fumes were notoriously volatile, even explosive. From New York, Captain Briggs set a course almost due east. The Mary Celeste would sail more than 5,000 miles past the Azores, through the Strait of Gibraltar, and into the Mediterranean, finally docking at Genoa, Italy. Ten days out of port, the Mary Celeste was buffeted by a howling storm.
The sea. Come in.
Excuse me, Captain. Ma'am, I've taken in the topsails, but she's still breezing up.
Winter winds whipped the Mary Celeste for better than a week.
I'd like to take in more sail.
Let's have a look.
According to the captain's logbook, the Mary Celeste stayed on course. On the 10th day, the weather cleared. In his log, Captain Briggs placed the Mary Celeste a mere 6 miles off the Azores. The date of the entry was November 25th, 1872, the last entry ever made by Captain Briggs. Ten days passed.
Mr. Wright? Captain?
On board the Dia Gratia, Captain Morehouse was about to make a discovery that would plunge him into controversy.
Something strange off the starboard bow, Captain. Looks like she's floundering. A couple of sails have blown away.
Can you tell yet who she is?
It's the Mary Celeste.
Avo! Captain Briggs!
The Dia Gratia's first mate, Oliver DeVoe, led a boarding party to the Mary Celeste.
They came near, tried to signal it, received no return signal, came closer to it, saw no one on deck. They thought maybe at first that it might have been what they called a fever ship. And they thought that maybe people were aboard down below dead of some sort of fever.
A haunting silence shrouded the Mary Celeste. If a killer fever had swept through the ship, it had left no victims behind.
You check below, I'll go aft.
Don't like this at all. Hello? Anybody below?
DeVoe was concerned to find the ship's compass shattered, and he was mystified by a long rope that snaked across the deck and off the stern of the ship. In the cabins, personal possessions, money, and gold jewelry lay undisturbed, as though everyone had been on board one moment, gone the next. The captain's navigation instruments and the ship's papers were missing. But Oliver DeVoe claimed he found no evidence of foul play, no reason for the Mary Celeste to have been abandoned. Only one fact was certain. The Mary Celeste and her precious cargo of alcohol could be worth a fortune in salvage rights to whoever brought her to port. Morehouse seized the opportunity. With First Mate DeVoe now at the helm of the Mary Celeste, the two ships set a course for Gibraltar. There, a British Vice Admiralty Court would review Morehouse's salvage claim. His arrival in Gibraltar provoked an immediate uproar. Rumors that Captain Morehouse was guilty of fraud and conspiracy swept the city, even as a court convened.
And you were the first to board the Mary Celeste. Is that correct?
That's right, myself and my second mate, Mr. Wright.
And when you boarded her, what was the condition of the ship?
She was in relatively good condition.
The government's chief investigator was a flamboyant Irishman named Solly Flood.
She
had a main spar cockbuild and her...
He was very suspicious. He had a certain bend for the dramatic, I think. He immediately saw foul play involved. And all during the proceedings, he tried to indicate that, there had been some sort of conspiracy involved here.
And Captain Morehouse and Captain Briggs of the Mary Celeste were friends?
They were colleagues. In fact, they had dinner together the night before the Mary Celeste left for Italy.
The night before the Mary Celeste set off. Do you think it's possible that the two of them might have been in collusion?
Sir, Captain Morehouse is an honorable man.
Yes, of course.
Lack of evidence eventually forced Flood to drop his allegations, but he quickly dreamed up a more sensational scenario, mutiny and murder.
And how many are empty?
Well, I found five or six right here.
The Mary Celeste was impounded. Inspectors under Flood's personal supervision combed the ship.
So, what do you think, Mr. Tolby?
They discovered that nine of the alcohol barrels were empty. Flood rejected all but his own explanation.
No, I think it more likely that the crew of the Mary Celeste opened up these casks.
Maybe we should investigate.
It was in Captain Briggs' cabin that Solly Flood found what he believed was proof positive of mutiny.
Mr. Stedman, are you familiar with this sword?
Aye, sir.
And what kind of a sword is it?
I take it to be Italian, about the turn of the century.
And what would a sword like this
Flood
be?
Had concocted a wild theory. The crew of the Mary Celeste had broken into the alcohol and in a drunken fury slaughtered Captain Briggs and his family. Then they fled in a lifeboat.
And could a sword like this inflict a wound?
You can inflict a wound with almost anything, sir.
Well, I suggest a wound was inflicted. Look at the stain on the sword.
Begging your pardon, sir, but I think you'll find that to be rust.
Well, I'll have a medical expert. No, a team of medical experts examine this, and then we'll see whether it's rust or not. Thank you, Mr. Stedman.
The tests would later reveal that the stains were not blood. The mutiny theory collapsed.
Flood just absolutely refused to admit that there hadn't been a murder. But he never did get any satisfaction from the government. And they just repudiated everything that he said.
The Mary Celeste is released from custody. A salvage settlement is awarded to David Morehouse in the amount of £1,700. The court can find no reasonable explanation for the abandonment of the Mary Celeste. She is hereby returned to her owners.
The Mary Celeste guarded her secret well. Today, many believe the answer lies with the ship's explosive cargo and the nine empty barrels.
That many barrels of alcohol leaking into the hold would have created a lot of fumes.
Conrad Byers believes that on November 25th, the last day Briggs and his crew were known to be on board, the weather had finally cleared enough to allow the hatches to be opened.
Oh, my God.
Mr. Richardson, come here.
Terrible odor in there. We'll have to vent the hatches.
I'll alert the captain.
I think immediately he sounded the alarm, knowing the dangers of this cargo and its chances of spontaneously combusting.
The fumes are quite overwhelming. What's to be done?
See to Tolby.
I think he planned to get everyone in the lifeboat and trail behind the main ship with the idea the cargo would either vent itself and cool off or explode.
You, man the peak! Cut! Let's go!
Byers believes the sails were lowered to prevent the Mary Celeste from picking up speed once all hands had abandoned ship. A single rope was all that would tie the lifeboat to the Mary Celeste.
Position!
Move line!
They're away right here until they got the boat.
Mr. Richardson,
sir, take the equipment.
As soon as we're away, get an exact position.
All right.
What destroyed their plan, really, was that they didn't have time to get all of the sail off of the vessel.
Put Mrs. Briggs in the line and her.
They piled into the boat and started trailing behind. And suddenly a gust of wind came up and started moving them.
Safe now.
The Mary Celeste lurched forward. The lifeline snapped.
Heavens, man, the line!
What about the line?
Man, it's mine!
Man,
it's yours!
Man, you're ours!
It's yours, man!
We're losing it!
is inbound.
Shorelock.
Ready to reach the line, sir. Make for it. Come on.
The vessel just sailed on without them and left them there.
Oh, we must get to that line.
The Mary Celeste would drift another 380 miles until Captain Morehouse came upon the eerie spectacle of the silent, abandoned ship. No trace of Captain Briggs, his family, or the crew was ever found.
Some years later, a British newspaper causes sensation with its account of a skeleton found bleaching on a remote Pacific island. Inside a bottle lying near the remains was a message. It claimed that all those aboard the Mary Celeste had been kidnapped to serve on another vessel, only to be shipwrecked off the coast of South America. The author of the note claimed to have been the last survivor. In the end, the story proved to be a hoax, and the secret of the Mary Celeste remains to this day a tantalizing, unsolved mystery.
When we return, surprising discoveries add an exciting twist to a heartwarming update. Recently, we took you on a journey into the magical world of the traveling carnival. We profiled Brenda Abbey and experienced firsthand her efforts to unravel a personal, unsolved mystery. Brenda was adopted as an infant. She knew little about her birth parents, Elizabeth Hansen and Walter Perry, except that they were employed by the Settlin and Wilson Carnival during the 1940s.
Every time I hear over the news that there's a carnival, I will go. And I go up to every booth, every concession. I go up to every person that's employed by that carnival, and I look at them just to see if I can find somebody that looks like me.
How long have you been with the carnival?
With the carnival, 18, almost 19.
During a search that spanned 30 years, Brenda talked with countless old-timers.
Are they with the carnival?
Nope.
No.
Each had a story to tell, and some even offered suggestions, but not one claimed to know Elizabeth Hansen or Walter Perry. Inevitably, as each carnival was packing up and hitting the road, Brenda Abbey was left behind, no closer to finding her birth parents. It seemed she might finally be out of options until the night of our broadcast. The response was far greater than even Brenda had hoped for. Not only did her birth mother call our phone center, but so did a sister and a brother, then another sister. Additional calls were logged in from friends of still more siblings.
Brenda Abbey was saddened to learn that her birth father had died in 1959, but she was thrilled to discover a total of 11 brothers and sisters. One of them, Martha Oak of St. Clair Shores, Michigan, hosted a reunion in August of 1994. Although Brenda's birth mother was unable to attend, Brenda finally met four of her long-lost brothers and sisters face to face.
As hostess for the celebration, Martha was the first to welcome Brenda.
Hi, Brenda.
Hi. How's it going?
A brother, Thomas Chillog, flew in from Louisiana, 1,000 miles away. Another sister, Susan Donner, came in from Port Clinton, Ohio. Brenda's brother, Frank Smith, grew up in Greenwood, Mississippi. Like Brenda, he never imagined he had so many siblings.
I did my own search and kept running into dead ends and finally gave up. And when I found out about this, it was incredible.
It's amazing. It's unbelievable. Totally unbelievable. It's funny to actually walk up to people and touch their skin and know that they're related.
The get-together in Michigan promises to be just the first of many.
And Bill said.
Plans are already underway for the next reunion.
These are my flesh and blood, and it's something nobody can take away from me.
That's right.
And it's such a great feeling.
It's worth the search.
It was worth the 30 years that it took me to do this.
Next, the uplifting search for three good Samaritans who befriended a runaway on a bus trip to Texas. In 1980, a girl named Michelle ran away from home. She was just 15, trying desperately to make herself appear older and more confident, even though on the inside, she was scared to death. Michelle knew she was playing a dangerous game. Even with a ticket seller, she was careful to cook up a secret identity.
Hi, my name's Lisa Haley. I'd like to buy a one-way ticket to San Antonio, Texas, please.
4 months earlier, Michelle's family had moved from San Antonio, Texas to Fairfax, Virginia. Michelle felt her parents had callously uprooted her from friends, family, and school. Now Michelle was going back to Texas, the place she thought of as home.
I was scared at that point just because I'd never really been anywhere by myself before, and this was an environment that I wasn't real familiar with. I had never been among all these strangers before, and you know, people would look at you, and first I thought, well, maybe they're just wondering why I'm young and I'm on this bus by myself, but then you kind of get the idea that people are, especially men, you know, are mainly looking to see that you're alone and, you know, try and bother you. That's when it really started to be scary because I couldn't protect myself and I didn't. You know, nobody knew where I was. So if something would have happened to me, nobody would know it.
At a stop in North Carolina, three men boarded the bus together. Michelle could never have guessed the profound role these men would play in her young life.
I remember thinking, you know, as far as men goes, I was staying away from as many as I could. And especially one of them looked pretty scary. He had really a lot of scars on his body. So I was sitting next to him and I thought, that's great. But they came and they sat around and they were talking among themselves.
Picked up a couple, man.
I think you sleeping up, man.
Wow. I'm tired.
You ain't done nothing.
The three men dozed off and on. Michelle stayed nerve-wracked and sleepless.
Sunshine. Wake up.
Sunshine, time to get up.
Are you there already, Doc?
No, man, I just need somebody to talk to.
Somebody to boy.
Yeah.
Oh, I hope I wasn't snoring too loud, fellas.
Hey, no, man, but Tiny Feet was calling the hogs.
Whoa. Tiny Feet does not snore. Thank you very much.
Right. The jovial trio completely disarmed Michelle.
Tiny Feet, don't steal
She
me.
Forgot for a moment that she was scared.
Why did they call you Tiny Feet?
Are you kidding?
The one really big guy, his name was Tiny Feet because his feet were huge.
Thank you.
No, miss, we're truckers. And Tiny Feet is his handle. See, me, I'm a deacon in my church back in North Carolina. They call me Doc because I got a Bible verse for everything that ails you.
That's right. My name is Sunshine.
Yeah.
Named after my favorite song, actually. Want to hear it?
No.
No, really, I can sing. Yeah. I can sing.
Yeah, the problem is he doesn't know when to shut up.
Never. And your name is?
Lisa.
Lisa! I was going to say this.
Pretty name.
Aren't you kind of young to be traveling by yourself?
Yeah. No, I'm 18. I'm going to Texas to visit some friends.
Oh, Texas.
I did this right outside of Dallas. Oh, yeah. My truck jackknifed, I went straight through the windshield.
Hey, man, I remember that. Mm. Remember
That's
you and
scary.
I didn't think he was going to make it.
I almost didn't make it. My family is what pulled me through.
That's right.
You want to see a picture of my family?
Sure.
hey, be nice.
It just made me feel like, you know, he was more of a family man and I didn't really have to worry. And the rest of them talked about their families and Doc kept talking about his church, you know, and the people in his church and what they were like. And I just, I felt at ease with them then. I didn't feel like I had anything to fear from them.
By the time the bus pulled into Atlanta, Doc, Sunshine, and Tiny Feet had practically adopted Michelle. When they sat down for breakfast, Tiny Feet noticed a young girl in trouble.
Just leave me alone.
Sweetie, I want you to come take a ride.
Leave me alone.
No, wait, hey, excuse me. Look, is he bothering you?
Yes.
Listen, we're about to sit down and have breakfast. Why don't you come join us for breakfast, okay? Let me just talk, okay? All right.
She came over and we bought her breakfast and she told us her story, and she was a runaway also. And, you know, I guess at that point I kind of sat back and watched and saw how they helped people. And it wasn't just me, it was other people. They were just like good Samaritans on the road kind of thing.
You guys?
Yeah.
I haven't completely been honest with you. My name isn't Lisa, it's Michelle.
Michelle?
And I'm not 18, I'm 15. And the reason I'm on this bus is it's because I've run away from home.
What made you leave home?
Got really bad.
For example?
My parents, they moved me away from all my friends, and now I have a curfew.
That is not that bad.
Not at all.
Felt like it.
Well, have you at least called them since you left?
No, I didn't leave a note, and they don't know where I'm at.
They're probably very worried about you.
That's right. If it was my kids, I'd be going crazy.
Yeah, it can get real dangerous out here. Real dangerous.
They pretty much knew that all along, I think, that, you know, I was younger than I was supposed to be and that I was running away from home. And, okay. You know, they didn't react badly to it. They were actually really comforting about it, and they knew that I was scared. And that's the first time I was actually able to tell somebody, I'm really scared doing this.
Next morning, the bus rolled into Mississippi, where the men were to take delivery of three trucks. The time had come to say goodbye.
Listen, I want you to take my card. It has both my home number and my church number on it.
Okay.
And please, if you ever need a place to stay, call me.
All right.
My wife and I have plenty of rooms. You gotta promise to write when you get where you're going, okay?
I will.
All right. Bye.
Well, young lady, this is it. Remember what I told you. Watch who you talk to.
Okay.
Okay? Take care of yourself.
Gonna miss you, kiddo. High five, stay alive. Be safe, okay?
It turned out that Sunshine couldn't leave without one last request.
Listen, Michelle, all I ask is that you call your mom and let her know you're okay.
I will.
All right, will you do that for me? You promise. Good luck.
I was sad to see them go. So I think they were worried about me. And I started to worry about me too when they got off the bus, because all of a sudden I felt scared and alone. You know, I didn't have people to protect me anymore.
At another stop later that afternoon, Michelle decided to keep her promise to Sunshine, at least in a way.
I got up there and I lost my nerve, and I didn't have the nerve to talk to my parents, because by this time I realized that they'd probably be really upset. So I called a friend of mine and I asked her to call my parents and let them know I was okay.
Hi, it's Michelle. No, I'm fine.
After I made the phone call to let my parents know that I was okay, I got back on the bus and there was a girl there, probably my same age. She was young. And she was sitting by herself with a paper bag full of things.
Hi.
Hi. Where are you headed?
I want to see my boyfriend.
I'm gonna go visit some friends in Texas.
Oh, that's great.
You want some donuts? I have some extras.
Yeah.
I guess I switched somewhere during that trip to, instead of just thinking about myself and how terrible my life was, you know, to thinking about other people.
Want to talk about it?
It's a long story.
We have time.
I had to get away from my old man.
You know, listening to stories of people on the road and other runaways, I wasn't a typical runaway. And when I listened to their stories and then think about my reasons, or they'd ask me, you know, why did you run away? I didn't want to say because it sounded so stupid by then, you know, that, oh, well, my parents gave me a curfew and, you know, made me catch the bus in the morning. You know, it just sounded so ridiculous compared to their really tragic stories.
Michelle finally made it to a friend's house in Texas where her father picked her up. Michelle was relieved to go back home. Join me next time. Perhaps you may be able to help solve a mystery. Thank you.